So if you've been coming along the last few weeks, you know that we're exploring material in this book, What is the Dharma? By Sangharakshita. And last week, Jnanavacha talked about or introduced the topic of, well, the chapter, in fact, in this book entitled The Texture of Reality. And so I'm going to continue with that this week and conclude the most important material from that chapter. So first of all, I need to just to recap what's happened so far, what Jnanavacha spoke about last week, as best I can. Actually, I can't remember what he said last week, to be quite honest, but I do know what's in the book. So he did roughly follow that. So the texture of reality is the title of the chapter. And the reason why you've got these two words together, texture and reality, is that the term reality is actually quite an abstract term. In fact, Sangharakshita points out there is no equivalent traditional Buddhist term to reality. And because it's an abstract term, he wanted to give it something of a, I suppose, a kind of experiential sense to what it was we're actually talking about. So he spoke about the texture of reality, or introduced this idea of the texture of reality, because texture is something you touch, you feel, you've got a very definite sense of it. It's something which impinges upon your physical sense. So the texture of reality, to try and get us out of the idea of an abstract reality. Nonetheless, we are going to use that word reality. And in the book, he speaks about the two kinds of reality. And Jnanavacha said quite a bit about this last week. The two kinds of reality are fundamentally what we call conditioned reality and unconditioned reality. So you have this distinction made between the conditioned and the unconditioned. That which is free from conditions and that which is conditioned, that which is compounded. So there's a contrast made between these two. So the whole of the Buddhist path, if you like, the whole of the Buddhist life, would involve a process of moving from conditioned reality to unconditioned reality, or at least noticing or trying to bring about a change in our experience, so that we move from an experience of the conditioned through to an experience of the unconditioned. So we have these two kinds of realities, conditioned reality and unconditioned reality. So the goal of the Buddhist life is towards the unconditioned reality. And this came about, if you like, because Siddhartha, the young Indian aristocrat who eventually became the Buddha, reflected when he was quite young, and reflected upon the fact that, well, this conditioned, this world in which he lives, the society in which he lived, was conditioned. It was subject to birth, subject to death, subject to old age, disease, and decay. It was compounded. That is to say, it didn't last. It was made of different parts, which would resolve it back into their elements. And reflecting in this way, he wondered, well, he realized that this did not lead or did not conduce ultimately to happiness. And so he asked himself, well, what if I pursue that which is unconditioned, that which is uncompounded, that which is not born, is not subject to death, old age and disease? And so reflecting in this way, he embarked upon what he described as the Noble Quest, the quest to realize the unconditioned. And that is, if you like, the Buddhist life, the quest to realize the unconditioned. But before proceeding any further, we have to ask the question, well, what is the conditioned? What is the unconditioned? Well, to understand that, first of all, we have to understand what is conditioned. What is conditioned existence? What is the conditioned? What am I talking about when I use that term? Well, the easiest way to describe this is, as it is traditionally done, by giving an account of what are known as the three Lakshanas. And this is what Jnanavacha began to explore last week. The three Lakshanas, or the three signs of becoming. And these three signs, or these three characteristics, characterize our experience. So what are they? They are, well, there's dukkha, which means unsatisfactoriness or pain. Usually better unsatisfactoriness than pain, but certainly it involves pain. So the conditioned existence, life as we know it, if you like, is characterized by the experience of unsatisfactoriness. The second characteristic is that of impermanence. Conditioned existence is impermanent. Nothing lasts. All is subject to death and decay, or anything which is made of parts, which is compounded, eventually falls apart. And the third characteristic is insubstantiality. Sangharakshita usually prefers to render this particular characteristic as insubstantiality. What it's pointing to is the fact that there is nothing which is permanent and fixed in our experience. So I'm going to say quite a bit more this evening about these second two characteristics. But I'd like to actually begin by going back to dukkha, to the experience of unsatisfactoriness. Because in a way, that's where the whole of Buddhism begins. Sangharakshita himself, many years ago, wrote an article, an essay, entitled Where Buddhism Begins and Why It Begins There. And he points to the fact that Buddhism begins with dukkha. It begins with suffering or unsatisfactoriness. And he makes the point that this is very significant. Buddhism does not begin with a theory. It begins, or an idea of any sort, or a concept. It begins with an experience, the experience of unsatisfactoriness, or of pain even, which is universally felt. Would anyone disagree with that? Anyone not experienced pain? I think we all know what it is. But I'd like to say a bit more about unsatisfactoriness before proceeding to the other two lakshanas or characteristics, because they are intimately connected. And so I'd like to make that connection clear. And I'd like to do that by relating the experience of dukkha to my own experience. I mean, of course, I've experienced dukkha just as much as you have in different ways. But I want to look at it from a very particular point of view, because it's not, for example, as is frequently misunderstood, it's not that the Buddha is saying that everything you experience in life is unsatisfactory or that it's painful. We all know that there are moments in life when that's not the case, that we have our moments of pleasure, of enjoyment, and happiness. So you can't really say that everything we experience is dukkha or unsatisfactory or painful. But the happiness and the pleasure that we experience usually doesn't last, or it doesn't really finally fulfill us. So when I was young, I was an actor, and I wanted to become an actor from a very early age. Well, actually, I wanted to get up on the stage from about the age of four. I wanted to be a comedian, to be quite honest. But anyway, that's all I understood at that time. Eventually, at the age of 16, I was totally stage struck, and I wanted to become a great classical actor. That was my ambition. And so I trained, I became an actor, I worked professionally. I was doing quite well. I never had any trouble getting work. Work just seemed to come to me. But as I worked, in fact, almost from the beginning, I found that the theatre did not live up to my expectations. I think part of that was that it didn't make me happy. I thought I was doing what would make me happy, or make me happiest in life. I didn't want to do anything else. I couldn't think of anything else to do with my life. It seemed to me when I was in my teens, you know, that life without the theatre would be almost like death. I certainly didn't want to become a bank clerk or anything like that, which my parents would have liked me to become. That seemed to me to be a totally an acceptable way to lead one's life, an unsatisfactory way to lead one's life, if you like. So I became an actor, but it didn't make me happy. In fact, in the end, it made me thoroughly miserable. And I couldn't understand that. So what was going on was that I had, pursued the course in life which I thought was most likely to make me happy. And actually the opposite was the case. It couldn't really satisfy me. And I suppose once I'd realised that, well, I just couldn't continue. I couldn't pursue it any further. I lost my ambition. In fact, I stopped almost immediately. It happened very dramatically, almost overnight, when I realised that this would not make me happy. And that's when I turned to Dharma. That's when I got involved with this Buddhist community. So I suppose in my own way, I had some sense of this Buddhist truth of the unsatisfactory nature of conditioned existence. I could see that the life that I was pursuing was not going to make me happy, or at least not in a sustained way. I might have moments of happiness, but it wasn't going to make me happy all the time. In fact, as I've already explained, it had rather the opposite effect upon me. So this is the experience of many of us. We have certain expectations of life. We think that if we pursue certain courses of action, perhaps we pursue a certain kind of career, as I did, that it will make us happy. Or that if we have the right partner, well, he or she will make us happy. But also I found that that didn't work for me either. I found that, well, I mean, for instance, I fell in love, as one does, many times actually, but I finally found the right one for me, the right girl. She was my dream girl. And to my horror, after about 6 months, I fell out of love with her. And that was really traumatic. I could not understand that. How could this have happened? I wasn't going to find anyone better than her. So how did this come about? It actually deeply troubled me, because it just didn't make sense. But then I realized, well, if I can't sustain this love that I felt for her, I wasn't going to be able to sustain that for anybody. I think I also realised, on some level or other, that actually you couldn't sustain that kind of romantic love for the same person all your life. I mean, have any of you been able to do that? A few people definitely shaking their heads. Most of you, non-committal. Okay. examine your romantic experience. You don't have to tell us about it. But that was my experience. So what had happened in both these cases was that, if you like, a certain amount of emotional energy had been invested in the career and then in the girl, and neither could deliver. And it wasn't their fault, it was mine. My expectations of both were unrealistic. They were unrealistic because I was looking for fulfillment, for happiness, for meaning in life, from objects which couldn't give that to me. So when we speak about dukkha, or the unsatisfactory nature of conditioned existence, it's that sort of thing that we mean. So I guess what you have to do is examine your own experience and ask yourself, well, does this match with my own experience? Can I make sense of this? Is this what I've found in life? I mean, for example, why have you come to the centre? There must have been a reason. To make all this effort to meditate, it takes up a lot of your time if you're really concerned about it. And, you know, if you go on retreat, well, it's rather expensive, relatively speaking, you know. So there must be something that's lacking in your life, which has brought you here. And you think there's something here that might provide what's missing. And I hope you're right. But then you, again, have to examine your own experience and come to your own conclusions. But if you keep coming back, I would suspect that means you're beginning to find something here that you don't find in your life outside of a Buddhist context, or, let's say, a context where you're trying to develop consciousness, become a better sort of human being. Okay, so much for dukkha. Let's just leave that there for the moment. I better move on to what I'm supposed to be talking about this evening. The second and third characteristics. So the second characteristic is the characteristic of impermanence. The idea, or I would say the fact, that nothing lasts. I mean, surely you can see this. It's pretty obvious to most people. If you think about it, there's nothing that lasts, and especially nowadays, of course, because things are deliberately made not to last. So they fall apart, or they're out of date, they no longer work, and so on and so forth. But even leaving that aside, nothing really lasts. And whether or not we really take it on board, we are experiencing impermanence all the time. No two moments are the same. Everything's changing constantly. Your experience is shifting and changing all the time. There's nothing in that experience which remains static, which doesn't change. Well, think about it anyway. We'll come back to this later, and there'll be opportunity to pursue your questions about this, assuming you do have some. So I think most of us should be able to see quite obviously that the world in which we live is constantly changing. It's subject to impermanence. I mean, for instance, I can remember when I first came to London, which was way back in 1966. I came down here to study. And the London of 1966, which is, it horrifies me to say it, but it's, I mean, that's like almost 50 years ago. It is 50 years ago. The London of 50 years ago is incredibly different from the London of today. It's almost unrecognisable. The same basic historic landmarks are in place, but it's changed so much in so many ways over those 50 years. It's almost not, it's a different kind of place altogether, it seems to me. Now, I'm not going to start getting nostalgic about swinging London of 1966. It was swinging, but it had its drawbacks too. But it's changed. Of course it's changed. How could it remain static? Nothing ever does. We expect things, or we want things to remain the way that we like them, the way that we remember them, perhaps, but they never do. If I look at my face in the mirror now, well, I see a rather old man, which is not the kind of face I'd like to look at, and it wasn't the face I looked at when I was 22. I know, because I've got photographs to prove it. When I look at those photographs, it's almost a bit of a shock, actually, because I really have to struggle to think, to imagine even, did I really look like that? I mean, it's a very odd experience. As you get older, of course, you have these kind of rather strange experiences more and more. So looking back from the age of 68 to 22, it really doesn't, it's very difficult even for me to imagine how that became this, in terms of just physical appearance. Impermanence, it's around us, it is very much a texture of life. We can't get away from it, it impinges upon us, it's tangible. You can see it, you can feel it. For instance, if you turn a radiator on, then you turn it off again, you put your hand on the radiator, well, the heat just slowly disappears. So you can feel impermanence, even physically, like that. I spent quite a bit of time in Melbourne over the years, and Melbourne is quite remarkable in that it gets sudden shifts of temperature in a way that no other place I know does. It depends whether the wind's coming from the south or from the land, which is north. If it's coming from the north, it's warm. If it's coming from the south, that means it's coming directly from the Antarctic. And so the temperature can drop 20 degrees Celsius in a matter of 20 minutes. It really is quite extraordinary, but it does happen. And so such a rapid change as that, again, is another example of the sort of changing nature of the reality we experience. It's actually tangible. We can feel it even. We can feel it with our body. But impermanence, we have to learn to see impermanence in a deeper way even than this. We certainly need to acknowledge that we live in an impermanent, constantly changing universe. But we have to learn to see how that affects us directly, how it shifts and changes our own experience. And to really see that means allow that knowledge to affect the way that we behave. I mean, it's easy to see that the world, or relatively easy to see that the world in which we live is subject to the law of impermanence. But when you start thinking about, when you start applying that to yourself, that's another matter. I mean, for example, when someone dies, someone close to you, it's quite a shock to your system. Well, it's certainly always been that way with me. I had a particularly strong shock about just over a year ago in India when one of my friend's young daughter committed suicide. And it really shocked me because it was unexpected. She was young. She had everything to live for, as far as I could see. She was very popular with those that knew her. I was teaching in Nagaloka, our big centre in India, where we have courses for young Indian Dalits, that is to say people who have a background of untouchability, courses in Dharma. And she was very much a part of that. I mean, she was not a student there. But her father taught there like I did. He was involved in that centre. And so she would frequently be there. So all the students there knew her. And it didn't just affect me, it affected them. But even more so, it affected my friend. And I've never seen such intense grief in anybody before. And it really, it's like moments like this really, really bring home to you the fact of impermanence. When someone dies suddenly and unexpectedly like that, it really sort of makes you sit up and think. And for me especially, I was 67 at the time, she was 21, and she died so young. Of course, it is a bit different when someone takes their own life, but even so, it's nonetheless very, very shocking. And so this impermanence impinges upon us very, very deeply when this sort of thing happens. When someone dies, in whatsoever circumstances, it really hits home hard, because if it's someone we know, if it's someone who is near or was near and dear to us, well, it alters our life. It's almost as if part of us disappears with the death of that person. Part of us which can never be replaced, because nobody comes back from the other side of death. Once they've gone, they've gone. And it's like there's an absence felt. Something that was previously important to you is no longer there. And that's how impermanence affects us. But the natural human response is to want to refill the gap that's been left with something or somebody else. But unfortunately, that doesn't work. We can't really do that. Once someone's gone, they've gone. Our life has changed. But more importantly, it should remind us that we ourselves are subject to death. That one day, each and every one of us will die. I don't want to get in too somber a mood this evening, but it's just a fact of life. And if you really do realise that, then if it's the reality of your own potential impermanence, well, it's not even potentially, the reality of your own impermanence, you will one day die, all of us will. If you really take that on board, it will affect the way you choose to live your life. And so this is one of the reasons why we reflect in Buddhist tradition on these lakshanas, on the fact that life is unsatisfactory, on the fact that life is impermanent, the conditioned life. Because you can't rely on things which ultimately can't deliver the happiness that you seek, or which are impermanent, which are subject to change, constant change. The trouble is, we have certain experiences, like for example, at the moment, I'm sitting on this chair, which feels very solid, built to last. I feel quite comfortable sitting on it. It does feel secure. It's hard, it's tough, it's resistant, it's real. But of course, in the end, it's not, because sooner or later it'll start falling apart. The screws will come out, and it'll become irreparable at some point, and then it'll be dismantled, it might be burnt and transmuted into something quite different. So this chair, I have an idea of this chair, but this chair, in the end, that also is subject to impermanence, it will not exist. Even if its component parts do, a leg here, you know, part of the back over there, but they're separate. They're no longer chair. It doesn't give you that sort of experience of chair anymore. We'll come back to that in a moment. So I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. But if we reflect upon these characteristics of existence, then we will seek a different kind of experience, as the Buddha did. We'll seek the unconditioned. But there's one more characteristic I should mention first, and then I'll say a little bit about how we go beyond them, and then we'll open it up for questions. So the next characteristic is insubstantiality. This is the famous doctrine of non-self. According to Buddhism, ultimately, there is no such thing as the self. I think you can get some sort of inkling of this actually when you first start to meditate. If you sit down, you meditate, or you try to meditate, you start to meditate, what do you first notice? Is there any consistency to what goes, whatever passes through this skull? This heart, it's constantly shifting and changing. Our moods shift from moment to moment. Our thoughts seem to have a law of themselves, a law of their own, and they just ramble on endlessly, beyond our control, seemingly. There's nothing in there which seems to be permanent. And according to Buddhist analysis, there isn't anything in there which is ultimately lasting, which is permanent. Anything which you can identify with as yourself. This is the essence of the Buddhist doctrine of anatta, non-selfhood, or insubstantiality. So just as everything else in conditioned existence is subject to change and constantly changing, that applies also to ourselves. There's nothing fixed and permanent in our experience of what we consider to be me. So I'll say a little bit more about that later. But one last thing before I stop and ask for questions. The reason why we engage in reflecting on these characteristics is, as Jnanavacha also explained last week, is the more you go into the condition, the more you contemplate the nature, the characteristic of conditioned existence, the deeper you go into that, well, it's almost as if you come out the other side. So there sort of is another side, sort of, and that's the unconditioned. So if you really, really dwell upon, reflect upon impermanence, if you really see impermanence, really allow the truth of impermanence to change you, well, then you emerge into the samadhi of signlessness. If you were here last week, you would remember that Jnanavacha talked about this process in relation to dukkha or unsatisfactory. Contemplating dukkha or unsatisfactory leads ultimately to the samadhi, or the gateway, the liberation of the unbiased. So, with impermanence, you emerge into the samadhi of the signlessness. There's no sign. So, what actually is being pointed to here really is going beyond the idea of words, of concepts. I mentioned the chair a few moments ago. Chair is just a concept, it's just an idea. Ultimately, there is no chair. there's just wood and screws which have been put together in a particular format, which allows me to have the experience of sitting down seemingly on something solid and unchanging. But actually, the idea of a chair is just simply an idea. For the time being, it's a useful concept, but it has no ultimate validity. It's only a matter of time before this chair no longer exists. I don't know how long it's going to take, but eventually it will not. So, the signlessness means that you see beyond concepts, ideas of things. We use words, and they can be quite useful to help us get along with our everyday existence. But the problem is, for example, with the idea of this chair, is that I have a certain, inevitably, you sort of start thinking, well, that's a chair, and it will always be a chair, as if it's a fixed thing, something which doesn't change. But actually, it too is subject to the law of impermanence, and eventually it won't exist as a chair. So penetrating the samadhi of signlessness means that we see beyond the ideas of things, the concepts of things. With the lakshana of insubstantiality, if you really dwell upon the truth of insubstantiality, you merge eventually into the samadhi of voidness. Voidness, that is to say, of any kind of ultimate reality. There's nothing. There's nothing fixed. You see things. You see through the appearances of things. There's nothing fixed in what you perceive. So this gives you some idea of the samadhi of the voidness. But maybe I should pause there and see if you have any questions about this. Yes.